Well, it's March 17th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 12:44 hours Eastern Daylight Time, much earlier than normal, although it's afternoon here. And Ward Green with you again today for the study. Everyone, but little children especially. We didn't read 2 Chronicles 6 yesterday because it was a prayer of Solomon, and it was a long prayer in dedication of the temple, but it was even though it was public, it was I didn't believe it was suitable for public consumption, and chapter 7 is similar to that. It's got a lot of information there about the sacrifices made during the celebration of the completion of the temple. But before we get into any of that, we might comment on that briefly too. It would be incredibly narrow-minded, to quote from the article Joseph and Owen, to think that the Greek gods and goddesses, Egyptian and Roman mythology, and myriad manifestations of these embodied in the culture and history of a whole array of nations, all stem from Joseph and Jacob. Or would it? In all honesty, perhaps not. And when we study this article, Joseph and Owen, hopefully we will do that, maybe next, but it's hard to say. We will eventually understand this, but the idea that it is well known that Sesostris III, the pharaoh of Egypt of the 12th dynasty, who succeeded his father Senusret II, or Sesostris II, was a very, very tall, strong warrior who was well suited to be depicted as the god of war in the Greek and Roman mythologies, and also to be depicted as Hercules. He was the Egyptian Hercules, without any doubt among scholars. I think that's well recognized, but the Greeks, we know, they derived a lot of their mythology from the Egyptians. And so, and evidently the Romans derived theirs from the Greeks, because we have all these countless parallels between the two. Parables too, I guess, but parallel parables. We just can't start to talk about it because there's so many things that have to be mentioned if you get into the article, Joseph and Owen. But for those who are interested, it's highly recommended to read the article, Joseph and Owen. And if you do, you will find your mind will just be inundated with numerous correspondences between the language of the names of these gods and their images as well, or symbols. Like the symbol of Cronus was the sickle, but Cronus was Jacob, who moved to Egypt, and he was situated in the delta, which was the most fertile area in Egypt, so the sickle was very suitable for Jacob as well as for Cronus. And of course the son of Jacob was Joseph, and Joseph was the one who modified, at least in large measure, the canal named after him, Joseph's Canal. If he didn't construct it entirely, he modified it in such a way that the entire Fayum region became much more productive agriculturally, so therefore he's well suited by the description of being put in the position where his symbol is the pitchfork or the trident of Poseidon. But not only that, even Poseidon was the god of horses, and we know he rode a chariot and Joseph, we know, rode in the second chariot of Pharaoh when he was ruling over all Egypt as the second in command of Egypt. It's not hard to imagine that Joseph became the Pharaoh after that. It's not hard at all to imagine, but it's far more than that. It's not an imagining. There's such strong evidence that Joseph and his two sons were pharaohs in succession that it's really hard to deny that this really did, that it really happened, that it did occur in Egypt, that the Jews were the pharaohs at that point in the 12th dynasty of Egypt. It's just undeniable, and yet so seemingly incredible that I certainly found myself, you know, completely perplexed as to what I was going to do about explaining it. But in our Crucible article, chapter 8, paragraph 10, most of us, when we die, leave behind some evidence of our existence, even if that be merely an inscribed gravestone. The death notice is often the only proof that we did live. That might be sad. That's often true. Abraham and Rachel and Joseph have tombs known to all today. And if you're researching your own family history, you might be very grateful to find a gravestone of one of your ancestors, because it might be the only evidence you have. It's extremely valuable. The Bible says that Joseph's bones were carried by Israel. We know, under the direction of Moses during the Exodus, they took the bones of Joseph up out of Egypt, and just as the myth of the phoenix describes the myth returning to bury his father, so Moses depicts or satisfies the mythological figure of the phoenix, who carried the bones of Joseph up from Egypt to the back to the promised land from whence, or from which I should say, or just whence Joseph came. And Joseph's tomb was desecrated and destroyed in the year 2000 of the Common Era by Arab militants, unfortunately, but visits did resume and restoration was made. And that was basically not the very important part of the story, but reports that a mummy was once resting in the tomb persist. So the mummy may have been removed at some point, but the reports that a mummy was once resting in the tomb persist. In other words, the mummy of Joseph. And if I recall correctly, there's also a story that says that there's a tomb in Egypt in the Nile Delta region where they found it was empty, and it was believed to be the tomb of Joseph. But if that's true, it was not the tomb of a pharaoh. So it wouldn't imply that Joseph had been pharaoh, if that was indeed the tomb of Joseph. I think that was discovered by I'm trying to remember the Egyptologist's name. I can't remember right now. Joseph, though, according to the Bible, died at the age of 110 years in Egypt, which was not uncommon for men of that time, particularly the holy men, such as Abraham, who lived to be 175, I believe, and Isaac, his son, lived to be 185. And Jacob lived to be 147? Is that true? Something like that. Anyway, yeah, I think that's right, though. But we can look all that up because it's in the Bible. We can find all those things. And that's all that we have for today's study. I hope that was tantalizing regarding the mythology, because the mythology of the Greeks never made any sense to me when I was young. None of it makes any sense, I don't think, to anybody. Unless and until I for my, as far as my own opinion, my own learning goes, and my own revelations go, it made no sense to me until I got the idea that there were some correspondences between the Jewish family names and the characteristics of the Jewish family members, the sons of Jacob, the Israelites, that, namely, most importantly, the 12 sons of Jacob, because they're in Greek mythology, there are 12 titans, even though they don't correspond with the 12 sons. There are 12 titans, just like there are 12 sons of Jacob. There is an endless list of correspondences. And I just read a paragraph or three today in the article Joseph and Owen, and my mind was just mind-boggled. My mind was boggled again. I wrote it, and I can't remember one millionth of it, of what I wrote. There's so many things there. I'd like to do the study for the scripture of today's proverb first, little children, before we move on. Wait a minute. No, you know what? Yeah, we're not going to do too much in the Bible today, I don't think, but we'll do enough. But you know what I want to do? Oh, there's this amazing thing here. Let's see, what's this? Yes, I figured out what it was that Mr. Oppert was saying in his article about the biblical chronology that we talked about yesterday. It's based on the cuneiform, the inscriptions of cuneiform eclipses. And he realized that there was a Pul, the king of Assyria, and there was Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, both of whom were mentioned in the Bible. But the Menahem, as he mentioned, ruled from 771 to 760, as he says there. Now, I'm going to look for that myself. Here it is. Menahem, 771 to 761 in our chronology. Very similar to the chronology given by Mr. Oppert, just as I just showed. I've got to find it again now. Where is it? Here? Right. 771 to 760, almost identical to our chronology, so it's not a problem. But we also have the fact that Pul was mentioned during that time period, and Pul could not have been Tiglath-Pileser unless you moved the date of Tiglath-Pileser back to 761 at the very minimum, because he had to be present, ruling in Assyria at the time of Menahem, if he was the person called Pul. But that was a mistake by Mr. Oppert, as he later admitted. But he says this is no longer acceptable. But the thing is, there was a text. The point was, there was a text of Tiglath-Pileser. That's the part I was unable to summarize yesterday. There was a text that was belonging to Tiglath-Pileser that mentioned the name of Menahem. So it says, for a long time, Mr. Oppert writes, we know a passage, this is my translation of what he wrote in French, from a text of Tiglath-Pileser's verified by two copies, that in his year 8 he received tributes from Menahem of Samaria. And that's why, because he later realized that they couldn't move back the date of Tiglath-Pileser, there must be another Menahem. And we had a need for another Menahem in our chronology of the Bible, because there were 10 years where there was no king reigning. And he explains the rest of it in here as there having been a second Menahem followed by a return to the throne by, I believe it was Pekah, right? But the son of Menahem was Pekahiah, mentioned in the Bible as after the king Menahem, who reigned during the time of Pul of Assyria. And so we know that Menahem had a son named Pekahiah, and that identifies him as belonging to this time period during which Tiglath-Pileser did not rule. So it's very convincing here. But he also provides a very reasonable explanation of why there must be a second Menahem. And Pekah ascended the throne in 759. And when we look at our chronology, Pekah in 759, right? And then he says he was still holding the throne. At the death of Jotham in 742. And by 737 he held the kingship no longer. But there was an interval, he says, from 742 to 733, where Menahem reigned in Samaria. This person, perhaps the son of Pekahiah, and also calling himself Menahem, he also goes on to talk about him. But it's fascinating, really. It really is. His logical discussion, and he's supporting the Bible in everything he does. He's a very, very firm believer in the Bible. He's not an apostate from the Bible, such as King Solomon was. King Solomon was an apostate from the Bible and from God's love and from God's commands contained in God's word, the Bible. So that's why we're not worshiping or emulating or following Solomon all that closely, because we don't want to be like him. But there's some fascinating things that happened that we want to talk about. Maybe we'll jump ahead to, you know, first of all, we can review what Clark says about King Solomon in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, little ones. I think we should do that maybe. Clark's commentary, that's Amos. Let's see what we've got here. I'm going to go back to 2 Chronicles 6 and 7. So he says, Solomon, having ended his prayer, the fire of the Lord comes down from heaven, Jehovah's fire, and consumes the offerings. The people and the priests see this and glorify God and offer sacrifices. Solomon offers 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep, and the priests and the Levites attend in their offices. It's an obscene amount of sacrifice of animals. He keeps the feast 7 days and the dedication of the altar 7 days and dismisses the people. The Lord appears unto him by night and assures him that he's heard his prayer. So let's jump down to where in verse 7 he says, Solomon sanctified the middle of the courtyard that was before the house of Yahweh, because there he rendered up the burnt offerings and the fat pieces of the communion sacrifices, for the copper altar that Solomon had made was itself not able to contain the burnt offering and the grain offering and the fat pieces. And Solomon proceeded to hold the festival at that time for 7 days, and all Israel with him, a very great congregation from the entering in of Hamath down to the torrent valley of Egypt. Hamath would be apparently in the north of Syria. And the torrent valley of Egypt we know is in the south. But on the eighth day they held a solemn assembly because the inauguration of the altar But on the eighth day they held a solemn assembly because the inauguration of the altar they had held for 7 days and the festival for 7 days. And on the 23rd day of the seventh month, getting close to the eighth month, he sent the people away to their homes, joyful and feeling good at heart over the goodness that Jehovah had performed toward David and toward Solomon and toward Israel, his people. It's a little bit unusual because we know from 1 Kings chapter 6 that the temple was completed in the eighth month. And yet this is saying they were finished in the seventh month. So it's always interesting to see little details like that. It makes us wonder what they did in the intervening time, for example. Then it says, thus Solomon finished, in verse 11, 2 Chronicles 7, the house of Jehovah and the house of the king. And in everything that had come into Solomon's heart to do regarding the house of Jehovah and his own house, he proved successful. Now we can read, you're more than welcome to read 2 Chronicles chapter 6. I just didn't want to read it publicly. And I do advise reading it. But in verse 12 now, Jehovah now appeared to Solomon during the night and said to him, I have heard your prayer, and I have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. When I shut up the heavens that no rain may occur, and when I command the grasshoppers to eat up the land, and if I send a pestilence among my people, and my people upon whom my name has been called humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn back from their bad ways, then I myself shall hear from the heavens and forgive their sin. And that's basically a lot of what was said in 2 Chronicles chapter 6 as well. But it also says, it says here in verse 19, if you yourselves turn back and actually leave my statutes and my commandments that I have put before you, and you actually go and serve other gods and bow down to them, I will also uproot them, meaning you, from off my ground that I've given them, meaning you, and this house that I've sanctified for my name I shall throw away from before my face, and I shall make it a proverbial saying and a taunt among the peoples, among all the peoples. As for this house that had become heaps of ruins, everyone passing by it will stare in amazement and be certain to say, for what reason did Jehovah do like that to this land and to this house? And we know that Nebuchadnezzar burnt the temple in fulfillment of the prophecy that was uttered here as a conditional prophecy, that if they disobeyed, this would happen. And that is why they disobeyed, and that is why he brought upon them all this calamity. People will have to say it was prophesied in verse 22. But this is a remarkable time period, because in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, at the end of 20 years, we have Solomon had built the house of Jehovah and his own house. And then the cities that Hiram had given to Solomon, Solomon rebuilt them and then caused the sons of Israel to dwell there. Furthermore, Solomon went to Hamath-Zobah and prevailed over it. Then he rebuilt Tadmor in the wilderness and all the storage cities that he had built in Hamath. But also he went on. Let's see now, do we see it in here? Maybe not. Okay, it's not in this chapter where he gives a city to Hiram. At the end of 20 years, he gave a city to Hiram, seems to me. And that's not in this chapter 8. I thought it was for some reason, but it's not important that we talk about that today. What I was interested in talking about today, although that's important because that means that Hiram was still around after 20 years. Of Solomon's reign, or even of the temple construction, after the beginning of the foundation of the temple, 20 years after that, Hiram was still around as king of Tyre, which is necessitating his having reigned for about 54 or 53 years, which is why we made the comment in the article true about that, in the chapter about Noron Tyre. The length of the reign of Hiram was adjusted due to that scriptural reference to Hiram. But today I wanted to look at this Ezion Geber. Solomon went to Ezion Geber, and there's a wonderful footnote here in the Insight book. If we look at the second in part of that, verse 18, Hiram in the Insight book under Ezion Geber, they went in these ships not only to Ophir, but to Tarshish. And since the evidence is strong that Tarshish was in Spain, the comment is that they may well have transported the ships across because they had to go to Spain and navigate the Mediterranean, that the ships may have been transported in pieces over to the Gulf of Aqaba, which is where the north end of the North Sea is, the northeastern Gulf of the Red Sea, is called the Gulf of Aqaba, and they may well have been transported there, where they were reconstructed. So at least that's what some have suggested. But also in the article in the insight on Ophir, it's fascinating that it's speculated about. It's not written in this particular part of that article, but it is in the article Ophir, I believe, or it's either in that one. I think it is in Ophir. I've got it in my other copy of the Insight book. But yeah, it mentions that Ophir, there's some speculation about where it was, but it's thought to have been in Arabia after deciding between Africa, India, and Arabia. He decided it was in Arabia, most people anyway. Now, Solomon brought gold from Ophir in large quantities, 450 talents mentioned there at the end of 2 Chronicles chapter 8. And it's interesting because the Queen of Sheba also came from Arabia. So the mention of Ophir nearby to the textual references in the books of Kings and Chronicles to where the Queen of Sheba is mentioned, the mention of the gold from Ophir is also mentioned. So it's logical to assume or believe because of that Ophir was related also to Arabia, whence came the Queen of Sheba. And we'll talk about that later too, hopefully, soon. And not too much later, probably. But let's look at the book of Amos, which is the... What is that? Well, Daniel's the 27th book of the Bible. Hosea is 28, 29, 30. Amos is the 30th book of the Bible in the format that we're studying. And chapter 8 is what Mr. Clark comments on. I'd like to look at the comment because we might not have time to read it. And by thus doing... Where is it? Oh dear, okay. Where is it? Where's the comment? Is it still here somewhere? I think it is. I'm not seeing it. That's our article, right? Yeah. That's the article. That's own. We have that. Oh, the work. Oh, yeah, the wonderful. That's a statue of Sennacherib II, who, if Joseph was the same as that, then that's the face of Joseph. It's remarkable to think that we have that. There's the struggling of Joseph's two sons. It's just remarkable. The proverb for today. A prince who is faithful is true as a die. But he who is false makes a life of a lie. Proverbs 14 and 5. That was the proverb for today. Amos, I've lost what... I have it here, but I don't have it on screen. I know that it's there, but... The chapter begins, Clark says, with a fourth vision denoting the certainty and nearness of the destruction of Israel. Okay, so it's basically talking about their destruction again. I do recommend reading chapter 7 also, but the Sovereign Lord Jehovah, it says, this is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah caused me to see in verse 8, chapter 8 of Amos, verse 1. And look, there was a basket of summer fruit. Then he said, what are you seeing, Amos? So I said, a basket of summer fruit. And Jehovah went on to say to me, the end has come to my people Israel. I shall no more do any further excusing of them. So there. That's prophesying that. But we also see that Solomon's request for favor and so on, and Jehovah's answer to him, indicated that he was going to, when Israel disobeyed, he was going to cause them to be greatly disturbed or punished, right? He was going to cause justice to come upon them. They would be devastated, and that's what happened to the northern kingdom also. And the northern kingdom was not split in the time of Solomon. It was part of all Israel. They were still all one kingdom in the time of Solomon. And they split shortly after Solomon. Very shortly after. And the songs of the temple will actually be a howling in that day, is the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah. There will be many a carcass in every place. One will certainly throw them out. Hush! Hear this, you men snapping at someone poor. Even in order to cause the meek ones of the earth to cease, saying, how long will it be before the new moon passes, and may we, or we may, sell cereals? Also the Sabbath, And we may offer grain for sale in order to make the ephah small and to make the shekel great and to falsify the scales of deception in order to buy lowly people for mere silver and someone poor for the price of a pair of sandals, and that we may sell mere refuse of grain. They were cheaters of the scales. They would make the ephah small when they were selling, but when they were buying, they would make the ephah large. And when they were buying, you know, people as slaves or whatever, they would try to buy for the lowest price possible, and they would sell grain that wasn't even grain, it was just the chaff. Jehovah has sworn by the superiority of Jacob, never will I forget all their works. Will it not be on this account that the land will be agitated and every inhabitant in it will have to mourn? And it will, all of it, certainly come up just like the Nile and be tossed and sink down like the Nile of Egypt. Yeah, so it is appropriate that we've been studying the article on Joseph at the same time, because Joseph, or the article Crucible, the chapter on Joseph, because that's, of course, associated with Egypt, and it must occur in that day is the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah, verse 9, that I will make the sun go down at high noon. That's where we come into the eclipse. And I will cause darkness for the land on a bright day. So there was an eclipse in 784 in our chronology that was 2 years after the book of Amos was written, because the book of Amos begins with the statement, at least this is what we've posited in the genealogy, that this earthquake that occurred 2 years after the writing of the words of Amos, according to Amos 1:1. There was an earthquake 2 years after Amos wrote the book, and that this earthquake, according to other parts of the Bible, was when the king Jeroboam ran away. But we believe also that since the eclipse was also evidently prophesied there, that the sun would go down at midday, that sounds like an eclipse. So we looked for an eclipse and we found it in 784, which completely confirmed the chronology that we already had, even though it's not a total eclipse or anything. It's not, although we don't know exactly, I guess, if the exact nature of the eclipse, but it was evident and we documented it. We do know what we calculated it to be. We've already documented that in the article Moses and elsewhere, I believe, but at least in the article Moses. In parts 1 and 2, I think, of Moses, it mentions the eclipse. But that's all for today's video and study. March 17th is the date. 2024 is the year of the Common Era. And 1317 is the time in Eastern Daylight Time. And I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. And this is Cassie saying bye for now.